We're going back to page, remember we were on page 33? We're on the seventh line from the bottom. And if you remember, Jantso Kapa said, now what is the function of this sutra? What is this sutra trying to do when it divides things into literal and figurative? And then he answers his own question. This sutra, of course, referring to the section requested or spoken at the instigation of the Bodhisattva Dandanyanda Pak. And then there were two reasons to go into what it was. There were two reasons to present this sutra, meaning the third turning of the wheel. First of all, there are two reasons to get into the distinction between the figurative and the literal. The first one was that that jesha dambo de rangi tseni ki dupa dhamma dupa nisi yesu chewa. So sorry, I kind of spaced out there. Two functions. The functions or the reason for going into the exercise of trying to divide things into what was literal and what was not literal can be described as two. One, the first one would be to help students to approach those blanket statements by Lord Buddha in the first turning of the wheel, blanket statement saying everything exists by definition. And then in the second turning of the wheel, blanket statement saying nothing exists by definition. So it helps students to approach that. And then the function of the third turning of the wheel, which is that sutra wherein the Buddha explains the meaning of his other sutras, and particularly that chapter which was spoken at the instigation of that bodhisattva, assists you in making the distinction between what was it literal? Did he mean to say that all things were existing by definition? Or did he mean to say that all things, nothing existed by definition? Or are you to make a distinction between them? And then the point is that you are supposed to now go back to those first and second turnings of the wheel and decide, oh, this part of it he did mean, this part of it he didn't mean. And that's the first function, is to assist students in going back to those blanket statements and helping to determine what was spoken literally and what wasn't spoken literally. And then the second function was really the 13 of the wheel, meaning this sutra, right? The words this sutra was to assist students of the mind-only school, right? Those students of the mind-only school eventually to perceive emptiness itself. So it's to give them a means by which to perceive emptiness. And those are the two functions, those are the two reasons from the mind-only school point of view that Lord Buddha turned the third turning of the wheel, taught this sutra, taught this particular section, made the distinction between this is figurative and this is literal. We covered this yesterday. I'm sure it's in your notes for those of you who were taking notes.
Nothing.
Now there's going to be a position, a mistaken position expressed, starting on page... No, sir. No, sir. You can now open your notes. We're starting onto a new section. We're starting onto something new, so you can now continue on from the bottom of your notes. From the second page of... page 34, second line, on down to about the middle of the page, where in the middle of the line it says, Dodo. We are now getting another position expressed by certain scholars of the past, certain thinkers of the past. One of them is going to be Jonamba and his followers, people who throughout history have followed his point of view. And then there's another one, a Sakya master by the name of Turboa. And this is going to be their position. What is the position about? It's a position about the idea that the third turning of the wheel undertakes to prove or to show that the first turning of the wheel and the second turning of the wheel were figurative, spoken figuratively, and that it itself, the very words in which the first two turnings of the wheel are described as figurative, are themselves meant to be taken literally. And then there's a debate about it, about, he hasn't expressed it clearly, he's memorized this whole text, and he shot out those lines. You know, I don't think he wants me to actually translate them right now. But the point being something like, it sounds like they're going to try to prove that something about the third turning of the wheel indicates that all three turns of the wheel are literal. Okay, but I'm not sure how it's going to go yet. And he says he'll go through it word by word. So here's their position. It wasn't quite what I said. They say, look, we all agree that the third turning of the wheel was something literally spoken literally. It's something to be accepted on face value. But their idea of what the third turning of the wheel and our idea of what the third turning of the wheel are different. Don't forget that we look upon the third turning of the wheel from the point of view of the outcome of the exchange, right? After the exchange between the bodhisattva asking the question and the answer being given, based on that exchange, we define the third turning of the wheel as from the viewpoint of someone who's reached the outcome of that exchange. And they fall into the trap of defining the third turning of the wheel as all those teachings which the Buddha gave in the latter part of his life, towards the end of his teaching career on this planet. So they're into saying, now they have to say that because they believe the third turning of the wheel is spoken literally, and because they define the third turning of the wheel as all that which the Buddha taught in the final stage of his life, the final stage of his teaching career, then they think they're forced into the position of saying that everything he taught during the final period of his teaching career is to be taken literally. All that is to be taken literally, and not just the third turning of the wheel as defined by someone who has reached the outcome of the exchange.
That's right.
Now we're pointing to certain teachings that the Lord Buddha gave in the final period of his life, right? They are then forced to say that certain teachings that they point out to certain teachings that Lord Buddha gave in the final part of his life to people who were not even Buddhists, okay? People who had not yet entered the Buddhist path, and people, most of those non-Buddhist tenets, most non-Buddhist systems saying, if you ask them, do you believe that there is a self-nature to a person, that a person has some self-nature of their own, they would say yes, the person does. Almost every non-Buddhist belief system, if you ask them, does a person have some kind of self-nature, then they would say yes, a person does have some kind of self-nature. And then they say that, well, Lord Buddha, in the final period of his life, in order to relate to these people, in order to be able to communicate with these people, gave certain teachings in which he's a sort of expressing the opinion that maybe there is such a thing as a self-nature to the person, you see? So in order to, you know, he's in an audience of people who are all non-Buddhist, he's trying to draw them in or suck them in gradually or slowly into the Buddhist path, so he's sort of saying, well, you know, this person that has a self-nature, and he seems to be referring to something like that, to the self-nature of a person. We know he's doing that for the purpose of bringing them closer to the Buddhist path and then eventually getting them into where they won't believe that anymore. But at first he has to talk about in those terms in order to relate to them. Otherwise they couldn't relate to him at all. So from now we're starting to get into an issue with the belief of Jonamba and Toboa. And we're starting to get into a problem with there because the Buddha taught that in the latter part of his life. We're going to have to start saying, according to them, that this was spoken literally, and that he literally meant when he said, when he was trying to relate those people. So we're starting to encroach upon a problem here.
Nothing.
2 points here. One is that the actual wording of the Tibetan here is that Shende Rigchen Dr. Mawala Shemba means certain other schools, other meaning non-Buddhist, right, who believed in a self nature, Dr. Mawala Shemba, who held this belief. And then it says Trangwe Chiyudu, and Geshe-la's sort of pulling a pun here. Trangwe Chiyudu means in order to lead them or in order to guide. This is the past tense of Jem, like Jemba Lama, you know, in the prayer that we do. So Trangba means to bring them in or to guide them in. But this also happens to be a way of spelling the word for figurative, you see. So he's sort of pulling a pun. He says, oh, look, he's Trangwaing them, you know, into the Buddhist teachings. And then he goes on to say, you know, I've been looking around for some kind of sutra that was spoken in the third teaching of the third turning of the wheel that you might somehow interpret as the Lord Buddha saying that a person had a self nature. And I've come up with a certain sutra that we study about when we're studying Madhyamika. And this sutra is called Deshek Nyingbo, means essence of the once gone to bliss. Maybe he gets it. Chilintanga.
Thank you.
We freed them. Okay. It's called Deshek Nyingbo. Deshek Nyingbo means the essence of the ones gone to bliss. Okay. Deshek Nyingbo. And then it's called Takten Dendruk to Tembedo, which means showing that the thing which is unchanging, the thing which is stable, exists truly. Okay. So this is some kind of sutra where they call it the essence of those gone thus, that sutra which shows the thing which is unchanging, the thing which is stable or firm, which exists truly. Okay, so Geshe-la says I've been thinking that maybe that's, I have a couple in mind, and this is apparently in some group of four sutras which is discussed in the middle way teachings. Okay, but he says that teaching was given by the Lord Buddha in the latter period of his life. And even from the title, it would seem that to be that Lord Buddha is talking about some kind of self-nature of a person or some kind of firm person. And I think that these scholars are mistaking those words. Don't forget that Deshek Nyingbo, essence of the ones gone ones gone to bliss, right? Sugata, right? Is that what that refers to is the Buddha nature of a person. Okay, so essence of the Buddhas refers to your Buddha nature. Your Buddha nature refers to the emptiness, mainly to the emptiness of your mind. The fact that your mind is has the potential to become enlightened. And so they're taking that in that very common misconception about that concept, about Buddha nature, to mean that inside of a person is some little Buddha hanging out there, you know? And if you could just wipe off all these obscurations and things, you would discover deep within a person's being this Buddha with all the 112 marks and everything all set there and all pretty, beautiful, and already Buddha inside. And they took that to be the meaning, as many people have, through, and you even see it nowadays in Western books, you know, that this is the meaning of Buddha nature, And if you could just wipe off these obscurations, you'd find the Buddha inside of everybody. And Geshe La says, they are looking at this concept in those terms, and that gets them very close to accepting the idea of a self nature of a person. You see, when you have non-Buddhist schools saying, oh, there is a real soul or spirit, or there's an inner being, you know, a permanent inner being, self-nature to people within them, which is part of them. Rangchesan means which is a part and parcel with their being, you know. Then you're getting very close to this other idea. So he says he thinks that they're referring to this sutra where the Buddha taught Buddha nature, because when you teach Buddha nature and you misunderstand the idea of Buddha nature, then you think that there's some kind of almost permanent inherent self inside of a person, part and parcel with the person, which would be the self nature of a person. So page 34, line 5 at the end, you start to get Jonamba's belief about things, Jonamba's belief about what the Buddha was saying, especially in the third turning of the wheel. They say that the only thing that really exists is emptiness, or Yongdu, totality. Okay, the only thing that really has any existence is emptiness itself, which is called totality, right, in the mind-only school. And what Lord Buddha is saying is that all the other things in the universe, all the things that you look at, all the things that a mistaken state of mind is focusing upon, right? When you perceive Yongdu, you're not being mistaken. When you perceive all these other things, you are being mistaken. So this mistaken mind is looking at all these other things and thinking it sees something, but those things don't really exist at all. So they're saying that all the objects which a mistaken state of mind thinks it sees don't even exist at all. And the only thing that exists really is Yongdu, or totality, and that exists in truth. That exists, that is something which exists he doesn't say by definition, but he says in truth. Those are the Yongdrups, or totality, or emptiness, is the only thing that exists really. And then all those other things which a mistaken state of mind thinks they see don't exist at all. And that's what the Buddha meant during the 13th. That's the distinctions that the Buddha was making in the 13th wheel. And when they say Lekpa Chewa, meaning making his fine distinctions during the third turn of the wheel, that's the fine distinction that he's making. He's making it between the things we think are truly exist and don't truly exist, or don't even exist at all according to Janamba, and then those things which truly do exist, and that's what it means when the Buddha is making fine distinctions during the third turn of the wheel. That's their take on what the Buddha is doing in the third turn of the wheel.
Kanso re kenda tabo ji kenda ngaro ma zo na
Then there was a great Sakya scholar named Dolpuwa, and he hailed from the same part of Tibet that Jonamba did. This is a place in Thang, which is north of Lhasa, which happens to be Geshe-la's own home state. And there was a place up there called Jonang, which is an area name. So Jonamba means the person from Jonang. And there was a great Sakya scholar named Dolpuwa, and he was a great scholar, especially of Garrett Denjil Lakemba de Dubois, let's say, right? And he was a very great master of the great scriptures of ancient India. So he had spent many, many years studying the classical commentaries, the Tengyur, from ancient India, and he had become a great master of them. And then he became aware of this Jonamba, who was teaching all these rather unique interpretations of Buddhism. So Jonamba is, becoming known to be a person who is reinterpreting Buddhism in special ways, coming up with special interpretations. And Dolpuwa had Sakya, the Sakya, great Sakya master. At first he had the idea, I will study these new interpretations of Jonamba and I will attack them. You know, I will come to Jonamba and I will prove that Jonamba's ideas are wrong. So he studied what Jonamba was saying, and eventually he came to Jonamba with the intention of disproving his interpretations. But then the more he stayed with Jonamba and the more he got influenced by Jonamba, eventually he decided Jonamba was totally correct and that everything Jonamba was teaching, these new interpretations, were actually the way things are supposed to be. And then, far from actually attacking him or proving him wrong, he became one of his most devoted followers and became one of the primary proponents of the Jonamba system. There is this sutra, called the Sutra of the Essence of the Sugatas, right, of the those who have gone to bliss, which shows that that which is unchanging and that which is stable truly exists. And, it does seem to say that there is a Buddha inside of all of this, all of us part and parcel, Rang Chesu, as part of us. It does seem to say it, but that's not something we can take literally, That's something we have to take figuratively. The Buddha didn't mean that there was a little Buddha hanging out inside of every single person as part of your person, okay? They take it somehow literally. Of course, we're not to take that literally. The Buddha didn't mean that. If there was a little Buddha in the middle of all of us that all we had to do was reveal, then things would be really easy. I mean, life would be easy. But you and I know it's not easy. We have to make a lot of efforts to study and to learn and to meditate. And it's not like, there's just some Buddha inside of you that suddenly you can become aware of and everything's okay. Obviously, things aren't that easy. We do make these prayers, right? In fact, it's the prayer at the end of class, right? Sunam Yeshi Tso Zoshin, right? And at the end of the class, we do say, you know, may I be able to accumulate that huge amount of merit and wisdom which is necessary for a person to become a Buddha. And you know, you do these prayers all the time. All the time you're saying, may I be able to one by one accumulate those mighty karmas, those mighty deeds that are necessary for me to become a Buddha, those two collections. And we're making these prayers constantly over and over again. If it was that easy, we wouldn't have to make these prayers all the time. These prayers are indicating that it's a step-by-step process of accumulating one by one these great energies that are required to turn yourself into an enlightened being. And the prayers themselves are indicating that that's necessary and that you have to do that. So if it were the case that there were just some kind of pre-made Buddha within us and we just had to reveal it or something like that, we wouldn't have to go saying these prayers, by the way, written by Arya Nagarjuna, right? That may I one by one collect all the parts necessary, the energy necessary, you know, by very great gradual effort, collecting together all that necessary massive energy to turn myself into an enlightened being. We wouldn't have to do that, would we? There wouldn't be any prayers like that, would there? So what was it that when we say in our prayers that you have to collect one by one the energy to become a Buddha, right? Then obviously, if we compare that statement to the statement in that sutra of the Suggathas, right? The sutra of the very nature, Suggathagarbha, right? The essence of the ones gone thus. If you say that statement is, if you look at that statement and then you go to the statement in that other sutra where the Buddha said, you know, you have a self-made Buddha inside of you. The Buddha is inside of you. You have already the Buddha inside of you. Obviously, then this statement in the sutra becomes figurative, something we have to take figuratively. It's just like Geshe-la says, the second turning of the wheel, where the Buddha said, nothing has any nature of its own. From the mind-only state point of view, that has to be figurative. That has to be something that the Buddha didn't mean literally, and that you have to go try to figure out what he really meant. And that sutra wherein the Buddha said, you know, there's a Buddha inside of you, you have the Buddha inside of you, I'm there within you, you know. Obviously, it's like the second turning of the wheel from the point of view of a mind-only school person. This is something we have to interpret. And Geshe-la says, I think you jumped the gun and told them already what the Buddha nature really was. And I'll say it again, the Buddha nature, especially according to the middle way school, is the fact that your mind is empty. You know, the emptiness of your mind, you know, generally speaking, there's nothing you can take all the way to Buddhahood with you. You know, there's nothing about you that's going to be there the day you get to Buddhahood, but you can take the emptiness of your mind, and the emptiness of your mind is the potential that will allow you to become an enlightened being. So that's what the Buddha meant when he said Buddha nature, and that's what he was talking about when he said Buddha nature. And so obviously this is again something which must be interpreted. This again is something which was spoken figuratively. You do have a Buddha nature. It's not that you have some kind of prefabricated Buddha sitting there inside of you or something like that. Nothing. I forgot to do one thing from his last statement. He said he had the idea of gongshi. Gongshi means what the Buddha really had in mind. Okay, so obviously there's a gongshi, or there's a thing that the Buddha really had in mind when he gave the second turn of the wheel, according to the mind-only point of view. And then there's something that he really had in mind when he talked about a Buddha being inside of you, a prefabricated Buddha inside of you, and what he had in mind was the emptiness of your mind. Okay, so that's from his former one. Now he says, you know, we could stick to the scripture, this book, and the book just trumbles on, you know, the book just goes on. It mentions briefly about this sutra in which the Buddha seemed to indicate himself, and then it just goes on, you know. And why do I go out, why do I keep going off on these minor tangents to clarify what sutra it was, what sutra, what he said in the sutra, what he didn't mean in the sutra, what he did mean in the sutra? Why do I keep going off on these tangents? What I have in mind is that, although it's a bit of a detour, I'm thinking that you guys are Westerners. You're going to come up against people who are going to raise questions with you. You know, they're going to come up to you and say, "Hey, I read this sutra the other day. You know, I found it in the bookstore, and it says that Lord Buddha said that there is a prefabricated Buddha inside of you. And I heard you say the other day that there's not. And I think, you know, all you Buddhists are contradicting yourself. You know, like you can't get your story straight. First, Lord Buddha says that in one scripture, which I read, and then you go along and say something else. Now, what did he have? You know, what's the point? Are you guys contradicting yourself?" And you have to be in a position where you can say, "Ah, there's this thing called gongshi," which means what the Buddha really had in mind when the Buddha said something. So he's trying to get you sensitive to the idea of gongshi, meaning what the Buddha really had in mind when the Buddha said different things. So you'll be in a position when somebody raises these issues with you, and you'll be able to state clearly, "Oh yeah, the Buddha said lots of things that he didn't mean literally. He meant that figuratively. Here's what he had in mind. He had in mind that we do have an emptiness of our mind, which gives us the potential to become enlightened." And you have to be, the reason I'm going off on these detours is to give you guys the tools or the ammunition you're going to need in the West when people raise issues with you on apparent inconsistencies in the Buddhist teachings. Now we have the eighth line from the bottom of page 34. On this point, other people have come and said, okay, meaning that now there's introduced another group of debaters named Yang Zhopa, Rinchen Do did appear before, way, way back there, at the very beginning, way back at the Chujyu. Chujyu means at the very beginning of the book, there's a section called the Offering of Praise, It's a standard part of a Buddhist book. And in there, there was an oblique reference to other groups trying to use this reasoning or something like that. And Geshe-la's at that point said, if you look back at your notes, there was somebody named Rinchen Thok who was struggling to understand these things but didn't understand these things, and we gave him as an example. Yandopa, Yando is a Yardore, Yangdore. There's a place called Yangdok. It's like Topeka or something, okay? And he's called the Topekan, okay? Yandopa Rinchen Thok. Now he goes to Jonamba, to the Jonambas, and he makes sort of like two complaints. One, he says, I don't like your take on this whole thing. I don't think your take on things is correct. Secondly, I don't even think your interpretation of what the third turning of the wheel was about is correct. You know, when you say that the third turning of the wheel was meant to make certain distinctions, like this distinction, that distinction, I don't think that you're correct, even in what you think the third turning of the wheel is. And so there's going to be some complaints from Yangdopa. Geshe-la says he thinks he's a Sakya scholar. Okay. This is a very interesting objection. He comes along and says, you know, if you take the third turning of the wheel, if you take the section spoken at the instigation of the Bodhisattva Dhammayanda Pak as making the distinction between what is to be taken literally and what is to be taken figuratively correct, if you say this way, the way in which that exchange describes the what is to be taken literally and what is to be taken figuratively, if you say that distinction, the way it makes that distinction is correct, if you say that distinction is correct, the way it makes the distinctions is correct, then you are forced into the position of Jonamba. Okay? Meaning, if you say that the way that the sutra, that section of the sutra, describes the difference between the figurative and the literal is correct, then you're going to be forced to say that Jonamba is correct in saying that since that chapter or that section indicates or proves that it demonstrates that the third turning of the wheel is to be taken literally, then you're forced into saying exactly what Jonamba says, which is that everything the Buddha taught in the latter part of his life is to be taken literally. And this is Yangdopa's complaint. And he says, we can't accept that, can we? You know, we can't go around saying that everything the Buddha spoke in the latter part of his life is to be taken literally. And so there's an interesting take on Jonamba's view, which is that he's right. Jonamba's right that if you take the manner of making the distinction between figurative and literal in that sutra, based on what the Bodhisattva, if you take that to be correct, then you have to take the third turn of the wheel to be literal. If you take that as being literal, then everything the Buddha said in the latter part of his life had to have been literal. So we must not accept the interpretation of the third turning of the wheel of that sutra as being literal itself. You know, we can't buy the way they divide the figurative and literal, or else we do get into the problems that Jonamba is into already. So basically what Rinchen Thok is saying, Yangdopa is saying, that we cannot accept the distinction between the figurative and literal which is presented in that third turning of the wheel. By the way, he also said, I forgot to translate from the time before, that Yangdok is a place where there's a lake, and the Chinese have named that lake something else, and the lake is called Yangdok. And I said, is it the blue lake, you know, Songlong? We said, no, that's out in Amdo. This is now over towards Song, and that's called Yangdok.
Mm.
So people ask Rinchen Tho, well, how are you going to do it? You know, if that's not how we make the distinction between the literal and the figurative and the literal, then you know, come up, tell us what your idea is, because if this is not what Rang Luk, meaning the position that we are to accept, is, then what is the position that we are to accept? And he says, you know, Rinchen Tho comes and says, consider the middle turning of the wheel, right? And then the third turning of the wheel. Switch them. Reverse them. Okay, so third turning of the wheel becomes second turning of the wheel, and middle turning of the wheel becomes the last turning of the wheel. So he says, switch the latter two turnings of the wheel. Then we're okay, he says. Don't forget that this is not our position, okay? Don't start blowing your mind and saying, oh, wait, all this time you've been teaching three wheels and now you're switching. He says, this is not our position, okay? We are reporting the position of this guy named Rinchen Tho. His position is that, hey, let's switch the second and third one, okay? he feels like he has to say that because poor Robert Chilton. You know, like that. Right? And he like, looked a little freaked out. So, you
know.
That Paba Dan Tama Di Jebogya Sea Di Rinchen Tho Ki Samcha La Di Sim Zambi Tawa Yin Sim Zambi Rang Lu Yin Se Yore Kona Rang Yin Lu Yin Ali Ali
Ali Ali
Ali Ali Ali I just wanted to describe to you what he wants to do. You see, this guy, Rinchen Tho, he wants to take the second turn of the wheel, third turn of the wheel, and switch the realm. That's his own idea. That's what he wants to do. Now, whether or not he thinks that that's what the mind-only school would want to do is something I can't say for sure, and I didn't really think about it, but I guess probably you'd have to say he would think that this is what the mind-only school would want to do, but I haven't really thought about it much. Actually, what I wanted to do right now, I want to describe to you his weird idea where he wants to switch these two. Rinchen Tho's main idea is that if you look at the three turnings of the wheel, you know, of each one building on the one before, you see what I mean? Of each one being a refinement of the one before. You know, that supposedly if a person is teaching throughout his teaching career, then he should be building and building upon what came before. So that the subject matter of each succeeding turning of the wheel should be better, higher, more sophisticated, more true than the turnings of the wheel that came before it. And he says, if you look at it, in the third turning of the wheel, we got this thing where he's trying to lead in people of other belief systems, and he's talking about almost in terms of a self-existent self, you know, that you guys mentioned, Yujonamba mentioned. If you look at that kind of subject matter, and also you look at the subject matter of the second turning of the wheel, in which Lord Buddha blew it away, you know, he said, oh, emptiness, you know, here's what it is, you know. Obviously, that subject matter compared to this subject matter is higher. It's more, it's supreme, you know. So really, let's order the three turnings of the wheel, not in terms of historical sequence, but in terms of, you know, refinement and reaching a higher level of meaning, you know. So we'll just take the second and third turnings of the wheel, says Rinchen Dog, we have to, and reverse them so that the order is correct in terms of a constant refinement and moving on to a higher level of meaning. Now we have an interesting problem. You see, there's a scripture called Sungyagi Wamushibido. There's a I don't know the Sanskrit for it, but there's a sutra which was requested by a king whose name was Lord of all secret words, or something like all Lord of incantations, or something like that. And this, in this particular sutra, which will be spoken about more later on, there is a criterion given for the ordering of the three turnings of the wheel. And in that particular sutra, it says that when you order the three turnings of the wheel, it should be in order of importance, or in order of content or subject matter becoming more and more refined. And that's the way that there's a certain order of the turning of the wheel which appears in that sutra, which was requested by this king. And then there's a order of the wheel that you guys have come up with, or a justification for the ordering of the wheel in your drupdun, right? In the outcome of the exchange. According to you, given the exchange that occurs in that sutra called the sutra in which the Buddha explains the intent of his sutras, right? You've come up with this justification for the order of the three turnings of the wheel. You know, in the third one, it was revealed that the first two were figurative, and then that's the ultimate one. And you've got some kind of criteria that you've established by virtue of the exchange. And then there's this other criteria for the ordering of the wheel, which comes much later in this text. It's explained much later in this text, in which the Buddha says each turning of the wheel should be better than the last, or it should be more refined than the last. And Rinchen Dok says to us, don't you think that your version of the turning of the way in which we order the three turnings of the wheel and the Buddha's version of the order of the three turnings of the wheel should match? You know, don't you think there should be some correspondence or correlation between that sutra in which the king requested the sutra, in which it presents the rationale for the ordering of the three turnings of the wheel, and your rationale for the ordering of the three turnings of the wheel? Don't you think they should match? Don't you think they should at some point, you know, correlate to each other? Does the fan bother you, or is it all right? Okay. Do you want a little bit more, or would it bother you?
Mm-hmm.
Then we come up and say, look, it's not necessary that all the presentations of the order of the three turns of the wheel, it's not what you say that we have to match this way of ordering the wheels, or that we have to accept this rationale of the ordering of the three turns of the wheel, and therefore we can't have our order of the three turns of the wheel. That's not a necessarily true. You know, there can be these two rationales for the ordering of the wheel. It's not necessarily true that they have to match. Your statement that we have to match that other sutra is not true. And anyway, old Rinchen Dong, you know, you want to move that chapter requested by the Bodhisattva Dundam Yandapa, right? You want to move that chapter to the second turning of the wheel, right? And he says, right, I do. You know, and then, I mean, the second turning of the wheel according to us. You see, Geshe-la keeps saying, according to us, according to us, according to us, you see? Because he doesn't accept it anymore, right? So we have to say, you're saying that now we have to move this one to the second turning of the wheel according to us, to what we used to say was the second turning of the wheel. He says, yeah, right, that's what I say. Then we say, well, in that sutra itself, in the sutra in which the Buddha explains the meaning of his other sutras, and specifically in the chapter requested, spoken at the request of the Bodhisattva, isn't it true that in that chapter itself, Lord Buddha describes the three turnings of the wheel? And doesn't he say, oh, the first turning of the wheel took place at Varanasi, it was spoken for the benefit of those who had entered the path of the listeners, right? And in that teaching, the Buddha gave the following teaching about the following subjects matter. Right, Rinchen Dong? That's right. And then doesn't it say, in the second one, you know, Lord Buddha went through all these existing phenomena and said none of them exist by definition, and then it says that was the second one. Doesn't he, Rinchen Dong? He says, right. And so doesn't Lord Buddha himself, in the turning of the wheel, that you want to move to the second turning of the wheel according to us, say that the first two turnings of the wheel were like that, and that the second turning of the wheel wasn't that sutra. It was the turning of the wheel where he said that nothing existed by definition, right? He says, no. Okay? And he says, what do you mean, why not? He says it's the second, right? And then Rinchen Dong says, second can mean a lot of different things, you know? He said second, you know? Second can mean all sorts of different things. I'll tell you what second means. Second doesn't mean second turning of the wheel. Second means second belief system. And Lord Buddha is not talking about the second turning of the wheel when he says that was the second one. He's talking about that's the second belief system. What? First turning of the wheel, or the first, was the belief system of the Hinayana. And then second just means the Mahayana group of people, you know, that thing when he said nothing has any nature of its own, by definition, Lord Buddha was just talking about, Lord Buddha was just talking about the second group, meaning, the second group meaning the Mahayana people. So they wasn't talking about the second turning of the wheel. So Geshe La says, I don't know, that's what Rinchen Dong says, that's what Rinchen Dong wants to say. Rinchen Dong's like, you know, this is his position.
What?
But Geshe-la is quick to point out that Rinchen Tok is correct on one thing, right? Which is that even according to our own system, right, the second turning of the wheel is amazing. I mean, it is the highest in the sense of meaning, you know, content. From that point of view, Rinchen Tok is not wrong. You know, we do believe that the second turning of the wheel was the one in which the Buddha reached his highest degree of expression, the highest degree of meaning. Can we go back and prove that somewhere? Is there some place in the book here that we can go back and establish that that Rinchen Tok, Yandopa Rinchen Tok is correct when he says that the second turning of the wheel, according to us, our version of the second turning of the wheel, is the highest one, is the one in which the Buddha reached his most supreme expression? He says, yeah, we do believe that. About that, he's correct. Go back to page 27. The third line from the bottom. He says, that is to say, that turning of the wheel in which Lord Buddha taught everything emptiness, you know, everything was empty, is exceedingly amazing, okay? Unbelievably amazing. That's the exceedingly is the che, okay, in Tibetan. Che means most especially exceedingly amazing, okay? And then when he got to characterizing the first turning of the wheel, which is on page 27, sixth line from the top, he says, he just says, amazing. He's talking about the first turning of the wheel. So our own characterization of the first turning of the wheel is amazing. Our own characterization of the second turning of the wheel, in which Buddha concentrated on emptiness, taught emptiness, is most exceedingly amazing, you know? And Geshe-la says, that proves that even according to our own beliefs, to our own belief, the second turning of the wheel was the most important. That is the one in which the Buddha reached his highest form of expression. So Rinchen Tok is right about that much. So, you know, if you're not careful, you might actually start to believe what he says is correct, you know, that maybe you should switch the second one over to the third
one, you know.
And then Geshe-la says, but what is our real own position? You know, what would you be What would you have to say is our actual position on this whole matter? You know, what did he mean when he said most exceedingly amazing? You know, what does that mean? And he's quick to point out that in our own system, he's going to express what we really believe. And he says, what we really believe, we can't go saying that one thing that the Buddha said is better than the other thing that the Buddha said. You see what I mean? You can't say that, oh, this thing the Buddha said is good and this thing the Buddha said is stupid or something like that. That's not the point. When we say most exceedingly amazing or something like that, what we're talking about is not so much that his words are more amazing, not even so much that his content is more amazing during the second turning of the wheel, because in the third turning of the wheel as well, he teaches emptiness. Okay, so you know, you can't go saying that the second turning of the wheel is better than, for example, the third turning of the wheel because it teaches emptiness, because it does. The third turning of the wheel does teach emptiness, but there's a difference in the method or a difference in the methodology, the difference in the way in which the Buddha teaches emptiness. In the second turning of the wheel, Lord Buddha uses a great many different reasonings to demonstrate emptiness. Even in the Prajnaparamita literature, this is called through unlimited means or through unlimited types of reasoning, the Buddha taught emptiness during the second turning of the wheel. So, you know, through not just many or not just through a multiplicity, but through an infinitesimal number of ways, Lord Buddha taught emptiness during the second turning of the wheel. Then when he got to the third turning of the wheel, it was in more of a sort of a limited way, less kinds of reasoning, not such a vast amount of reason. So from that point of view, even though we can't accept that one teaching of the Buddha is better than another teaching of the Buddha, or that one is higher than the other, and that even the subject matter here, they are both high subject matters, but it is in the method he uses, or in the amount, or the intricacy, or the many different ways of angles at which he gets to emptiness in the second turn of the wheel makes it most exceedingly amazing. Okay. Therefore, you can appreciate the statement. You know, when we say that there's this distinction between the second and third turning of the wheel, the methodology that the Buddha used, the manner, the intricacy of, and the multiplicity of his presentation in the second turning of the wheel as opposed to the third turning of the wheel, now you can appreciate what we say when we say that the second, by the way, we mentioned this before, that the second turning of the wheel was designed, the second turning of the wheel was directed towards mind-only students of extraordinary mental facilities, extraordinary mental levels, you know, who had much, what we call sharp powers. And then the third teaching of the wheel was taught or designed or directed more for mind-only school students of lesser powers. So now, because of this thing I just said about the meaning of most exceedingly, right, you guys should, in your own minds, start to get some kind of an instinct for why we say that the second turning of the wheel was designed for people of very sharp powers, and that the third turning of the wheel was designed for people of lesser powers. Now you in your own mind start to get a feeling, because of that crucial word, most exceedingly, you know, pivoting on that word, you can appreciate now why we say that the students for whom the second turning of the wheel was designed are of sharper or higher facilities, and that the students for whom the third teaching of the wheel was designed are relatively lesser facilities. Now you have a flavor of why, because of the intricacy of the presentation and the multiplicity of the presentation, almost the limitless multiplicity of the reasonings used to establish emptiness in the second turning of the wheel. So you got it right. That's you got that distinction of why one would be spoken for the sharp and one for the less sharp. So really the distinction boils down to this, doesn't it? There's one kind of person that if you present these intricate and very multifaceted arguments to them, they suddenly understand emptiness. And then there's another kind of student that if you confronted them with these intricate arguments, they wouldn't get it at all. And there's the difference between what we call relatively sharper and relatively duller facilities, mental powers. You know, we had a point this morning. Just like you say, we better go back to these points now because we're not going to finish the book on this trip. And we have to go back to these points. Otherwise, I bring them up, and then you're not really you're not really equipped to know what I'm talking about. So we're going to have to kind of jump to what was it? Remember, we said that there was a sutra requested by a certain king named Lord of Incantations or something like that, and he has requested teaching of the Buddha. And in that sutra, Lord Buddha has given a rationale for the ordering of the three turnings of the wheel. So we better go to that rationale and explain it now while we're on it, while we have a chance to get at it, and not wait for it to come way down at the end of the book, okay? The way in which the sutra requested by the king sets forth the order of the three wheels is exactly according to the three scopes presented in the Lam Rim teachings. In the teachings on the steps of the path to enlightenment, they talk about people of three different scopes. There are people of beginning scope or lesser scope. Then there are people of medium scope, and then there are people of greater scope. The greater scope being the Mahayana people, the people who follow the Bodhisattva's way. So you have these three different scopes, and according to the sutra requested by the king named Lord of Incantations or whatever, those three different scopes correspond to the three turnings of the wheel. So that all of the Buddha's teachings, which were designed or which talk about those subjects, which are treated in the works on the steps to enlightenment, the Lam Rim text, as relating to people of lesser capacity or lesser scope, are called the first turning of the wheel. All those teachings of Lord Buddha which relate to people of medium scope are called the middle turning of the wheel. And then all those teachings which Lord Buddha gave, designed for people of highest scope or the Mahayana scope, are called the third turning of the wheel. And that's how, that's the rationale given in the sutra requested by the king for the order of the three wheels, turnings of the wheel. Yeah, together. That sumbadila take chance chevala was. That the shuki dunda laya. That's a little bit delicate question to ask, because you can't like just jump ahead and say, because the third one relates to Mahayana people, the first two don't relate to Mahayana people. You know, you can have a kid in first grade who's like saying, you know, I'm coming to first grade, I'm going to sit in this chair because I want to be president of the United States, you know. And he can study in the first grade, he can sit through the first grade and say, with the intention and the motivation, I'm going to be president of the United States. And then you got other kids in first grade who are just sitting there taking up a chair. And that's all they want. They don't have any, they're not looking ahead at president of the United States or anything like that. So it's a little delicate to say that definitely someone in the first or second category are not Mahayana and that they're just Hinayana. But generally speaking, it sort of relates to the Hinayana. Yeah. Good, delicate question.
Yes,
Remember that, you know, Rinchen Thok said, your way of, your rationale for ordering the three turnings of the wheel better match the rationale for the ordering of the three turnings of the wheel. You know, when you talk about the exchange and the outcome of the exchange and how a person who's been through the exchange now views the rationale for the three turnings of the wheel order, and then the order as presented in this sutra requested by the king named Lord of Incantations, whatever his name is, okay? So this is why we don't have to match that one. This is what there is a big distinction between them. Where does the crux of the distinction lie? It's in the students or the disciples for whom the teaching was designed, right? This concept of that certain teachings are given with certain people in mind. You know, maybe other people will study those teachings, but there are certain teachings that when the Buddha gives them, he has certain groups of people in mind. Other people may end up studying them, but these teachings are designed or directed towards certain people. It's on that difference that we're allowed to say, oh, we can order them one way and they can order them the other way. Okay? What is the distinction between the two? When you talk about the order as presented in the sutra requested by the king, you can be talking about all three turnings of the wheel being designed for one single person. You see what I mean? All three turnings of the wheel are designed for the same people, for the same person. Meaning, when they're at this stage in their spiritual lives, the content of the first turning of the wheel is appropriate for them. And then you move them up, 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 you keep pushing them up, 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 they keep graduating, they keep getting higher in their spiritual life. Then the content of the second turning of the wheel is designed for them. And then they keep going on and getting higher and higher, like the Lam Rim, right? And then the contents of the third turning of the wheel become appropriate or designated or designed for them. So that when we talk about the rationale for the order of the three turnings of the wheel spoken in the sutra requested by the king, we're talking about students for whom it was designed that will end up being the particular students intended for all three turnings of the wheel, okay, as they move up in their own spiritual lives. But if you look at the rationale for the order of the three turnings of the wheel as presented from the point of view of someone who's been through the outcome of the exchange and looking at that, oh, this turning of the wheel was designed for those specific people of those particular belief systems or those particular capacities, and then this one was designed for those people, and the third one was designed for those people. There's no intention and there's no understanding that those people are all like one group of people that are going to be graduating and moving up to those. This was spoken for those people, designed for them. This turning the wheel was designed for these. This turning the wheel was designed for these. And so that's why we say to Rinchen Thok, we don't have to necessarily match the rationale that was used for the order of the three turning the wheels, three turnings of the wheel, that was presented in the sutra requested by the king. That's not a necessity that we have to match that. With our understanding of who it is that these three turnings of the wheel were designed for, and your version of who these three turnings of the wheel were designed for, the crux of the distinction in the rationale is based on the students for whom those three turnings of the wheel were designed for. And since those are totally different in these two cases, it's not the case that the two rationales or even the three orders have to be the same. So did you get the point that this way of this rationale and this rationale is totally different? Got it?
やろうこれ、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、ちょっと、 Yeah.
So Jetsu Kapa, in his response to these two presentations, right? We had one by Jonamba, and we had the other by Rinchen Tho. And he's looking at these presentations and says, look, you know, you guys. Nothing. So Jetsu Kapa comes back to these other two guys. We've got Jonamba and we got Rinchen Tho. And he's saying, you know, first you got this idea, you know, you have this idea about what it means to be the first, the middle, and the final turn of the wheel. And then Rinchen Tho, you come up with some other idea about this is what it means to be the first, the middle, and the last turn of the wheel. And then, you know what the real problem is that you guys did not read that chapter spoken, you know, at the request of the Bodhisattva very well. You know, you didn't dig into it. You didn't examine its contents. You didn't think carefully, very, very carefully, about what is the Buddha getting at and what does the Buddha think are the three turns of the wheel. You know, you got sort of distracted by the expressions first, medium, and final, right? You're taking, you know, your mind is immediately grasping on to the meaning of first, medium, final, you know, and you are more focusing on the words first, medium, final, right? And you haven't gone so much into the meaning of what the Buddha wants. What the Buddha himself intends to say are his three turnings of the wheel. You're not paying enough attention to that section that was requested by the Bodhisattva. If you did, if you went straight there, and if you ripped it apart and studied it carefully, you wouldn't have come up with all this stuff. You know, you're getting distracted. You're almost like wasting my time. And then I giggled, and then Geshe-la says, well, you're not wasting their time. They're great scholars, and they have valid points to raise, and they're great thinkers, and you know, it means like, but you know, in a sense, Jetsu Kapa is trying to say, look, you know, why fool around, you know, go to the sutra, read it carefully, then you won't be saying all this stuff, you know. And then Geshe-la said, okay, translate it, and then he said, wait, I wanted to add something more. I don't want them to think I'm just making up this version of what Jetsu Kapa is saying. Let's go back to the text and find out where Jetsu Kapa is actually saying that. Page 34, about the sixth line from the bottom. And what they are saying is that, the way in which the Buddha divided figurative and literal in the last turn of the wheel is not be taken literally, right? And then they go on to say, he says, you know, really, both of these systems, meaning Dei Ni Ge Kyang, means both of your systems, both you, Jonamba, and you, Rinchen Tho, you know, the problem is that you haven't taken the time. You are raising these issues without having looked very, very carefully at the meaning of that section during the third turn of the wheel. If you had, we wouldn't have had to take this long detour. And Geshe-la says, yeah, and we wouldn't have had to take this long detour. Okay, that's okay. So if you think about it, we're about to embark on a new section, and you could say case is closed. You know, take everything in that section, close it up, finished. Ah, but wait a minute, you know? There's these two little points I was thinking about that I didn't tell you. I really wanted to tell you these two little points from from that section we were just on. So I'm going to just, you know, we'll just skip back and give you two little points that I was thinking about that I didn't mention to you. That's right. Page 27. He says, go back to page 27 where they did characterized both the first turning of the wheel and the second turning of the wheel. Now, I translated it as most exceedingly amazing. In Tibetan, there are actually two different words. One is amazing and one is wonderful. You know, he's saying the first turning of the wheel is amazing and wonderful. And then later on he says the second turning of the wheel is amazing and wonderful exceedingly. Exceedingly amazing and wonderful. So actually there's two words here in the Tibetan. I only gave you one of them. One is amazing, one is wonderful, with regard to both of those turns of the wheel. So he says, let's get into those two words.
Nice.
Why do we characterize the Buddhist speech as amazing? By the way, this particular word in the Tibetan newspapers, I remember, it was like Lotsang Lutung means Ripley's Believe It or Not. You know, like it means really happened but is amazing or almost unbelievable, right? So Lotsang means strange or extraordinary or amazing. Why do we characterize the first and second turnings of the wheel as amazing? And Geshe-la says, you know, amazing means there should be something extraordinary about it. There should be something exceptional about it. There should be something that sets it apart from all other things. What is it that sets it apart from all other things? What is it that makes it different or extraordinary or special that we can call it amazing? And he says there are two reasons why the speech of the Buddha in this case is amazing. In general, actually, is amazing. And he says, first reason is what we can call the motivation with which Lord Buddha speaks. Okay, so Lord Buddha is looking at a person and he's only thinking about what would be a benefit to them. It is only out of compassion that Lord Buddha speaks. So, you know, people like us, we might even teach Dharma with some kind of intention of being famous, or people will get to know me, or you know, people will talk about how great I am, or something like that. But Lord Buddha doesn't have any such motivation. The only motivation Lord Buddha has, he looks into your mind, each student's mind, and out of incredible love for them, out of incredible care for them, is only speaking because he wants to benefit them, and is only speaking what will benefit them. And his whole intention for speaking at all is that, is to look into the student's mind, see what would help them, and then give them what would be a benefit to them. Then dambo de kulo ningji chamba che dan nibin la sha And the second reason why it's amazing is that as far as content, right, how well does the speaker understand the content of what they're saying? You know, for us, you know, we could say, oh, I know it pretty well, or I didn't think about it too much, or, you know, people like you and me can say something, can make a statement, without really understanding all the implications or understanding everything about what we're going to say. But Lord Buddha's not like that. Omniscient being, knows everything in the universe, and based on that knowledge is saying something. So they know whereof they speak, because they're omniscient. And that's the second reason why their speech is amazing. Now we've covered the first adjective, amazing. Okay? So whereas the word amazing is sort of looking at from a causal point of view, right? What is instigating the speech of the Buddha? You know, what does the Buddha have in mind? What kind of understanding of the subject does the Buddha have before the Buddha speaks, right? Those are all sort of causal. Those are all from the point of view of before he speaks, or speech from the point of view of a cause, or the cause of the speech. Now we get into the word wonderful, metta-chunwa, which has is focusing on the result of the speech, okay? So, what does that mean? Metta-chunwa, says Geshe Lama, is something that is set apart, okay? The meaning of metta-chunwa, which in general in Tibetan is a difficult phrase, okay? It's not a very transparent phrase. He says, somehow it has some connotation of being set apart, something higher, okay, something extraordinary. And he says, what does it have to do with here is that from the point of view of goals, or from the point of view of the result of the speech, if Lord Buddha talks like this, if Lord Buddha gives instructions like this, and if each person follows it, they will get certain results. What? Suppose there are people who just want to become an arhat, you know, a reach nirvana on the listener track, you know, even if that's all they want, right? They're just saying, oh, I want to reach nirvana on the listener track. I want to get to the end of the listener track. If they follow these instructions perfectly, you know, the Buddha has given some kind of teaching. The Buddha has spoken something. If you do it step by step, and if you follow the instructions carefully, then those people who want to get to a listener's track, nirvana, will get there. Definite. And then suppose there's other people come along and say, I'm not satisfied with that. I want to get to the self-made Buddha's track, nirvana. You know, I want to get to nirvana on the track of self-made Buddha. Well, Buddha gave those instructions. Lord Buddha taught that. Lord Buddha's speech from a causal point of view will give you that result. You know, if that's all you want, if that's what you want, if you follow the instructions, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, get to the end, there, reach a nirvana, reach a nirvana according to self-made Buddha track. And suppose there's people say, wait, I want more, you know, I'm not satisfied unless I get on to total perfect enlightenment, you know. Even if people come up and say, you know, that's not enough for me, I'm going on to higher goals, you know. If they follow what Lord Buddha taught, one by one, follow them one by one, follow the instructions giving, then you will achieve that goal. So the Buddha's speech is wonderful, right? First was amazing, now it's wonderful. Wonderful from a point of view of goals. If you follow exactly the instructions, you can get whatever your heart desires.
Nani.
You might be wondering why I keep flipping back, you know, like why I keep going back to something we covered before and revisiting it to catch the meaning of a few words or a phrase or something like that. You know, my usual style in the monastery is I just truck through the meaning, you know, we just blast through the meaning like a rocket, you know, and we just go point to point, you know, I pick out all the important points, I pick out all the philosophical issues, and we blast through it like a rocket, and we just go shooting through it like that. And then that what happens is I get into that mode with you guys, you know, you're from another country, you're from another culture, and but I'm still in my old monastic mode, you know, when I have those other Tibetan students here, and we're just blasting through those meanings and going through like a rocket ship. And then when you guys go home, it occurs to me that, you know, I didn't go over these finer points with you that as Westerners, A, you might not be familiar with, that my Tibetan monks will be automatically familiar with, and B, you're going to be questioning things, and you're going to be questioned in a way that my students aren't going to be questioned. You see, you're going to go back to another country, you're going back to another culture, where they will be examining everything you say, they will be examining all the words, they will be examining and questioning things. I have to go back and remind myself, you know, that you guys are going to be in a more inquisitive, in a more questioning mode about the meanings of specific phrases, and you're going to also have to be, you're going to be in a mode where people are going to question you more in more detail. So then after you guys have gone home and I've gone through one of these rocket blast sessions, then it occurs to me later that I better go back and clarify certain words for you guys so that you can get a deeper appreciation for things that I can assume in the monastery with the other monks here. It's very important to you guys that as I mention page numbers, keep writing down the page numbers, okay? So like when I say page 27, line 3, you go down and write page 27, line 3. Because what happens is I come back and say, now we're going to go back and revisit something. Your whole presentation and your notes is going to get screwed up. It's all going to get out of order, you know? If you don't have it, a box written around and say, this applies back to page 27 that he taught before. If you don't order your notes that way, and I want you later to go back and actually physically reorder your notes. Take this information, go back to your notes, and stick it up there and put it in the right place. Otherwise, you know, you'll show these notes to other Westerners and they'll say, oh my God, you know, these Tibetan lamas, they're like crazy, you know. They're like mixing this and then they're mixing that and everything's all mixed up. And I don't want that to happen. I want you to reorder those notes, go back home, make them nice, and put them in the correct order. You know, what I just said was, oh, when I'm among my own Tibetan students, I'm going to like a rocket ship because I know, I understand, you know, I take it for granted that they know all these words and the meaning of all these words and everything like that. You know, from one point of view, I don't want you to make you feel like because I'm not doing that with you, I think you don't know anything, okay? But you know, even if you go check my other Tibetan students, you know, which I take it for granted, they can appreciate all the fine points here and all the deep connotations of these words. You know, actually, you could go back home. I know that you guys are staying over at Gerong House. Pull out one of those poor little monks. And I'm not picking on Gerong House. I could put it in any other house, okay? any other house in monastery. Go to some fine young monk and say, you know, we got these two words here, you know, amazing and incredible, you know, and could you just tell me, you know, what's the difference between there? You know, what's the fine difference in the connotation between that? You guys can, you know, I'm saying that I take for granted that they know, but you know, when I think about it, if you go ask them, what's the distinction between these two adjectives? Well, you go test this food yourself and tell me how it tastes.
That's right.
Nothing. There's a bit of a problem when I teach my Tibetan students is that, you know, if I stopped on words like these two little adjectives and I went into some long explanation about, oh, this is what this one really means and this is what this one really means, they would become impatient with me. They'd say, oh, you know, we're Tibetans, you know, we know what those things, we know what Lothar means, we know what Meditima means, you don't have to go over that with us. And knowing that they would not even appreciate it, I just go on, you see? I oftentimes don't stop to give them a fine point because I'm afraid that they will think I'm being nitpicky or unnecessarily nitpicky or that I'm bringing up details about things they already understand. So I tend to just truck on through and not stop on those points. Now we've reached a new section, totally new section, and he wants to, Geshe-la wants to give a brief introduction to that section, just a little brief summary of what that section is going to be talking about. In the first one, having explained about the three turnings of the wheel, having explained about figurative, literal, all that, now we're going to actually get into Arya Asanga's presentation of the mind-only school. Okay, so now don't forget that Arya Asanga is the Master Asanga is the innovator or the person who has opened, reopened, right, the mind-only school in this world. So first of all, we're going to go into Master Asanga's presentation of the mind-only school in terms of what does he say are his sources. Okay, so we're going to look at Master Asanga's presentation of the mind-only school from the point of view of when Master Asanga started to spread the mind-only beliefs, what did he think his authoritative sources were? And you know what he's going to say. He's going to go to the sutra in which the Buddha explained the true meaning of his sutras, Dodogongdo. He's going to go to this Samdhinimocchana sutra, and he's going to explain, first of all, Jetsun Kabe is going to explain what are Master Asanga's sources for beginning and espousing the mind-only school. That will be the first section. And how is it that he takes those sources, and what sources does he use, and how is he doing? That'll be the first whole section coming up. The second section coming up here will be what is then the main content of the mind-only school. You see, what is it that the mind-only school teaches? And especially, what do they teach with regard to the ultimate subject being emptiness? Okay, so the whole second section will be, here's what Master Asanga's mind-only school teaches, and in particular with regard to emptiness. So those will be the two sections that we're moving into now.
Mm.
We're about to run out of time, but if I just give you a very, very quick bypass over, you know, overview of what our Arya Asanga is going to identify as his own sources, we can go to two of his greatest books. One is called Dua, which is like the compendium, and or the abbreviation, and the other one is called Changsa, which means Bodhisattva Bhumi, in which Arya Asanga presents the paths and levels of the Bodhisattva. So we can go to those two books. Now, in those two books, when Arya Asanga is presenting matters of what Geshe-la calls minor points, okay? Matters of minor points, not very difficult points, okay? Points which are easily resolved, okay? Points which are not like major turning points or major pivot points, okay? Major key points. When he goes into those points, Master Asanga doesn't even bother to explain them in detail. He says, oh, you guys go look at Dodo Gongdo. Okay, remember that the sutra in which the Buddha explains the intent of his sutras is the third turning of the wheel. And especially in there, the chapter spoken at the request, in response to the question of the Bodhisattva Dunamyandapa. So one indication of where Arya Asanga believes his own sources are Arya Asanga's own statements in his two famous kinds of works, which are huge works, in which he says, oh, this point I don't have to go into much. You can get it from the sutra on the intent of the sutras because, you know, just go read that. I don't have to explain it much. It's very clear. It's not a very difficult point. You can get that from that sutra. So that shows that in Arya Asanga's own mind, his authoritative sources, most importantly, include the sutra, which is the third turning of the wheel. Okay. And then conversely, every time he gets to a very difficult point, a sticky point, a major point, you know, something, he always introduces it by saying, and you know, here's a point that you wouldn't get if you just went back to the original sutra in which the Buddha explains the intent of the sutras. So on this point, I guess I better go into some detail for you. And that is how he goes about writing his two great books, the abbreviation and the Bodhisattva, you know, the levels of the Bodhisattva. So it's interesting that he's also indicating that that's his source when he says, you won't be able to get it by yourself just by going back to the original sutra, which is the sutra in which the Buddha explains the meaning of the sutra, which is the third turning of the wheel, right? So I better explain it. And that's why and how Arya Asanga goes into writing these huge books.
Rira bring sin in the Yamadi, Sangye Sindhu Mide Wangi, Ndoku Nam Thakshina Chapasho, Kidam Guru Vana Mandala Kamli Yatayami, Vee Kevokun, Sanam Yeshe Tozashi, Sanam Yeshe Nature, Tambakuni.